The Magna Carta, of course, was signed in 1215. It's one of the world's most famous documents, celebrated as a cornerstone of constitutional government. And Australia owns a copy, purchased by the Menzies government and now on display in Parliament House, Canberra. The Aussie copy dates back to 1297 and is known as an inspeximus issue, meaning that King Edward I inspected it and confirmed that it is the Great Charter of his father, Henry III. This Thursday at the National Library, Libby Meltzer, who's the head of collection care at the State Library Victoria, is going to be giving a talk about the conservation of the Australian copy of the Magna Carta, a 10-year process recently completed, and that meant that Libby was the one with her scalpel touching a 700-year-old document now valued at around $35 million. No pressure. Libby Meltzer, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Good morning, Gillian.
Great to be speaking with you. Now, the Magna Carta owned by Australia has been preserved for decades in a special case made by the CSIRO back in the 1960s. I gather that the more recent preservation work had the first challenge of trying to open that case. Could you tell us about that and why it made what you described as probably the most stressful week of your life?
Yes, it definitely was that. So back in the sort of late 50s and early 60s, the CSIRO constructed what was an amazing sort of revolutionary bit of kit for the time, which is they built this oxygen-free display case, so full of argon gas, and it was built based on the same case that was used for the American Declaration of Independence. But the Australian case had sort of unique challenges, some of which was the fact that the Declaration of Independence is just a flat document, whereas the Australian Magna Carta had a seal, so the Australian case had to be like deeper, it had to be thicker. And also a lot of the materials that they talked about weren't actually available in Australia at the time. So we didn't have the actual designs for what they
built. I was going to ask you about that. I mean, didn't the CSIRO leave you a nice clear set of instructions about how to open it up, Libby?
No, they didn't, but they left us a really fantastic narrative of all the communication backwards and forwards. So we had the original designs for the Declaration of Independence, and then we had all of the communication between the various parties, so the National Librarian and the other parties of the CSIRO about what the challenges were and what they were doing differently. And we had things like what materials they purchased. So using those two bits of information, we then had to kind of reconstruct what we thought was happening with the case, because we could see bits from the outside, but we couldn't see what was going on the inside.
Yeah, right. So there were genuine concerns that the process of opening this preservation case could potentially cause damage to the Magna Carta?
I think it could have only if we did it very badly.
Sure.
So we put a lot of processes in place to kind of mitigate all of the risks. And so one of the things for us is, you know, trying to figure out exactly how to get in. So it's got it had two sort of toughened glass sheets on either side, and then it had lead sides, and it was sealed with solder, and we knew there was like another superstructure inside, or substructure, I should say, inside that supported it.
So what was it like opening it up?
Well, very stressful, because the way that we decided to get in was to cut in through the lead. And we actually ended up speaking to the conservator from the National Archives in the US who opened their case, and they went in through the lead as well, but our lead was thicker, so we had a lot more challenges. So we ended up working with Victoria University Polytechnic, and they designed us this fantastic tool, which was like a cutting blade that ran on a rail but had a micrometer on it, so we could go in sort of like incremental portions of a millimetre and slice in through the lead. And we also laminated the glass multiple times just to make sure that if anything bad happened, that was protected from that side. So the process of actually cutting through took us in excess of 4 hours. But unfortunately for us, as we went down, one of the things that we saw, it was inside the case, we could see a grey fibrous board, and we're all suddenly going, oh no, we don't know, what if it's asbestos? So then when we finally got to this final stages that we've been prepping for like about 8 months, we ended up having to do it all in sort of full hazmat gear.
Wow.
Which of course it wasn't. It wasn't asbestos. But can I say it was very hot? It was very hot to be doing all this in full hazmat gear. But yeah, it did. So that was a very stressful week of, you know, going down through the layers. But what we were able to figure out from the original designs and the archival research was actually really, really close to what ended up being in there. So it was a successful process in the end.
Fantastic. And that meant that you were able to undertake some very intricate restoration and preservation work and research. Could you tell us, Libby, about the ink used on this copy yes. of the Magna Carta, what you found out about it and what that means in terms of how the document should be preserved going forward?
Yeah, well, the ink is actually really, really fascinating. It's a very standard medieval ink. It's called iron gall ink, and it's what you'll find. It was a writing ink used from sort of early Middle Ages right through into the early 20th century, and it's got quite a unique way that it fades. So normally, what we find is when things fade, you know, they get exposed to light and they oxidize and they fade, and that's a sort of a one way process that's sort of all downhill. With this particular ink, it's sort of only come to light in probably the last, 15 years, that it's got sort of a unique fading pattern where it fades with sort of the reverse chemical process. So it's a reduction instead of oxidation, so it fades in the light, but it actually regenerates colour in the dark. So it has this sort of complex process, which means instead of us getting this lovely linear graph that makes us go this much light, this much fading, it's a much more complicated process. But one of the things it did mean as far as the final implications for how the Magna Carta is now housed is we decided to go for an oxygen atmosphere or, just an air atmosphere rather than one that had no oxygen, because there is the potential that oxygen is involved in this regenerative pathway. Mm. So we wanted to make sure that we gave it the best opportunity to regenerate any colour that it might lose.
So that's interesting. Does that mean that the decision made back in 1960 to use argon to try and get all the oxygen out, in retrospect, might not have been the best conservation decision?
It's a tricky one. There was obviously no demonstrable issue with it, and the same with the Declaration of Independence also in argon. It's a very hairline decision. So when we did a lot of research when we started this process and we looked at all of the other custodians of Magna Carta and similar documents and to see how they'd stored theirs, it really broke down quite geographically. North America, they love putting things in usually helium instead of argon, but oxygen-free environments. And in UK and Europe, they're very much about putting them in air. So it's, I think we are really looking at sort of minute, sort of fractions of issues, but just kind of our best understanding seemed like this would be the most appropriate approach. So I don't think it was a bad decision. It was definitely the absolute best decision at the time. Mm. And also we know that with the seal on the bottom of the Magna Carta that's got silk cords, we know that the oxygen-free environment would most definitely have assisted them in aging better.
So many complex considerations to take into account on Sunday Extra.
And it's the best science at the time too.
Yeah, indeed. We're speaking with Libby Meltzer, who's head of collection care at the State Library of Victoria. But Libby, as part of this research and conservation process, you did actually have your scalpel on this 700-year-old document, valued at around $35 million. Tell us about what you were doing with the scalpel, how nervous you were, and who else was watching.
So when we took it off, we were able to take it off the backboard and look at the back. We saw what we always thought was going to be there, which is that there are, I don't know if you looked at the pictures, but you see it's got some stains. Mm. And in those stains, the parchment is really quite flat. So we thought there's almost certainly some sort of repairs on the back. And so when we were able to look at the back, we could see that there were these really quite heavy, bulky parchment repairs that had been put on these, some tiny holes, but big repairs. And it was decided that if we could make those a bit thinner, so sort of overly strong, that it would be putting less pressure on the parchment itself. So the way to do this is really just to get a very tiny scalpel and work under a microscope. Which I did over a period of about 2 weeks, rock up to Parliament House in the morning and get taken down into the dungeon and work under a microscope with someone watching me. And, so the whole time when I'm paring them back really, really fine, to get to a really, really fine layer, everything that was going under my microscope was on a monitor, a big screen for other people to view as they went past. But they were very nice in keeping people away from me and not disturbing me as well too.
So. Fair enough too. No scope for error there. I gather that also some silverfish remains have been found on this copy of the Magna Carta. How did that come about, and how long have the silverfish been there?
Well, we know it had been there at least since before it went into the argon case, because one of the things that that oxygen-free case would have done is, you know, killed any pest activity. So I can't tell you. It was somewhere between 1297 and 1962. There was
it's quite a window.
Yes, it was. I was a bit disappointed in the end, because we found it in the when we were going through the silk tassels. We found this little insect fragment, and it wasn't complete. It was just a tiny, you know, bit of one. And I was a bit jealous, because one of my other colleagues who worked in a medieval manuscript had a plague flea in hers, and I was like, maybe I've got a plague flea, but I don't have a flea. It was a fragment of a silverfish. So the lovely entomologist at the Museum Victoria was able to identify from this sort of, you know, one third of an insect that no, it was most likely a silverfish. But yes, well dead, and from sometime before.
I've never heard of anyone wishing for a plague flea, so there you go.
Just a bit of drama.
Absolutely, absolutely. Libby, your talk this week promises new insights into the Magna Carta that the analysis of the materials has provided. What are some of those key insights?
The couple of things we found that were just interesting. So along the way, we were able to identify the species that the parchment was made of, so we can confirm that it's a sheep, because it was unsure whether it was a goat or a calf, but it's definitely a sheep. But the biggest bit of research that came out of this was another collaboration with the CSIRO, where we were given the opportunity to take some very tiny samples from the silk tassels. So the tassels are red and green, and we took one single fibre that was, you know, of each colour, so about 8 millimetres long, which allowed us to do some imaging to confirm that the silk was in really good condition. But then we knew we had the potential to analyse the dyes. But as you can imagine, if you've got just less than a centimetre of one single strand of 700-year-old silk, the quantity of dye in there is incredibly small. So we worked with the CSIRO, who were able to sort of extract those dyes. And bearing in mind the green is actually two colours, so it's blue and yellow together, they had to cut it in half and do two extractions. And then one of my other fabulous colleagues grew a lot of the medieval dye stuffs in her back garden over lockdown. And so then she created control samples that, along with some purchased material, the CSIRO was able to use to compare with the spectra that they extracted from, you know, these tiny samples. Yeah. Well, I think then that was pretty nerve-wracking for the poor scientists involved as well.
What a fascinating process. And Libby, you'll be speaking about it this week at the National Library, or the Conservation of the Australian Copy of the Magna Carta. Tickets still available, I'm told. And it's a big week for you, Libby, because also the State Library of Victoria has an exhibition called Rebel Heart opening up on Thursday. Could you tell us about that exhibition and what you were doing on that?
Oh, yes. So this is my new role. So the work I did with Magna Carta was through the Grimwade Centre at Melbourne University, but I've moved down to the State Library. So the State Library's got a fabulous exhibition starting this Tuesday, which is all about sort of love letters. So the team that I head up now has been doing a lot of work in preparing letters and sort of love mementos from across a whole range of eras. So right back to things like the Captain Moonlight letters that are on loan from the State Library of New South Wales, through to like Taylor Swift memorabilia and fan fiction from original Star Trek fan fiction from the 1960s. So it's a complete, absolute change of pace and a shift from the Magna Carta project. But yeah, just the diverse things that.
Yeah, totally. So it sounds relatively less stressful, but both fantastic events, one in Melbourne and the other in Canberra. Libby Meltzer, thank you so much for joining us.
Can I just say both of those things are Tuesday, not Thursday?
Okay, yeah, great. Fantastic. Thank you very much. And thanks very much for joining us today, Libby Meltzer.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Libby is the head of collection care at the State Library of Victoria. The talk is in the National Library in Canberra on Tuesday, and Rebel Hearts opens in Melbourne on Tuesday. And it, in fact, features an original musical composition by our previous guest this hour, Mindy Meng Wang. So lots of archival material to check out, together with some new music.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.